anytime by calling 1-855-KPFT-CAR or visiting kpft.org. Either way, it's easy and you will be contacted within 24 hours of the next business day to arrange for pickup. Thank you for supporting 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to Daniel Albeck. Daniel Albeck.
Did you just butcher the name of the show by removing most of the letters?
Daniel Albeck.
Or does he want yogurt in Russian?
That's yogurt in Russian is yogurt.
Well, as they say in Russia, welcome to Technology Bites in Russian. Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
All I'm right. Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
All right. Yay. All right. Boy, what is all the pounding? Is that you?
Peter?
Oh,
San Antonio?
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure how I could point. I was trying to point Peter Hughes.
Point at San Antonio.
That's what I was.
Hold up a Texas
map.
That's
why I did like that.
Peter's Googling for how to get sugar out of carpet right now.
No, actually, the volume coming from your end is very, very quiet.
Well, it's stealth radio. It just sneaks up on you and solves your problem.
And now is it louder?
Is that better?
I can make it really, really loud.
No, this is better, but it's not as loud as it usually is.
Turn it up to 11.
There you go.
All right, well, welcome to the show. You can visit us online at geekradio.com. You can hang out with us in IRC, irc.cuckoo.com, or if you're not comfortable using your own IRC client, you can go to the webpage at geekradio.com and use our Java client to connect to the IRC and join in on the show within a show. Interesting noises coming across my headphones.
Sounds like Skype.
Skype is full of weird noises. Are you calling other people? Are you party lining or what?
I was chatting online with friends. Maybe co-hosts.
All right. And if you want to contact us, you can do that via our website at geekradio.com that has all the information you need for reaching us. If you don't want to call in and be on the air, although we do encourage you to call in and be on the air because that's what makes this show what it is or what it's supposed to be, is when we have people calling in and asking us questions or talking to us about technology. So a little bit later on, we'll be opening the phone lines at 713-526-5738 to take your calls on the air. But first, we're going to go to San Antonio and do the Technology Bytes info shot with extra Skype noises.
It's the Technology Bytes info shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
All right. Well, usually I get a couple. Usually we don't go to the news quite this quick, so I wasn't 100% done getting set up, but still have plenty of news. This one's an interesting one. Global tablet shipments fell year over year for the first time in the March quarter, according to tracking data from NPD Display Search, where in the first part of 2013, 59 million tablets of all types were sold. The market shrank to 56.3 million last quarter. Paired with laptops, tablets nevertheless represented over half of mobile PC shipments. There's the percentages in that stuff. I think one of the things that's happening is that that's a sign that, you know, a reason for this happening is the stuff that's already been sold, the quality got good pretty fast. And so there's a whole lot of people who don't need and didn't need to replace their tablets. And so that's why they're not necessarily selling more year over year. At least that's my opinion. But it's interesting to see that happen. But I think, you know, there's the people who where it has to be constant growth or that's some sort of failure, and I think the reality is more like that this could be thought of as a sign of success. There's always got to be some not good news, right? I'm going to skip that one because it turns out to be an older story than I thought, and I don't know why it came up on my stuff. This one's an interesting Skype one, so we can have extra different Skype sounds. Microsoft is apparently working on real-time translation for Skype. Per TechHive, before the end of 2014, Microsoft plans to release a beta Skype app that will enable real-time translation of people verbally speaking in different languages. Skype Translator, as Microsoft has termed it, appears to be an extension of the real-time translation Microsoft has been developing for the past decade or so. As Microsoft notes, the new Skype Translator simply makes more sense than a dedicated app, given the different scenarios in which Skype is used, you know, in business, to talk to friends and relatives internationally, and also in education. Satya Nadella, Microsoft's new chief executive, introduced the new Skype Translator app at the Code Conference in Southern California, where Gurdeep Patel, Microsoft's corporate vice president of Skype and Link, demonstrated the technology with a German-speaking colleague. Demonstration not only provided an oral translation, but a text-based one as well. The original text, as understood by Skype, appeared at the bottom. Although the text appeared scripted, the demonstration was still impressive. The German speaker, identified as Diana Heinrichs, however, clearly enunciated each word precisely, while Paul was less formal. It's currently unclear how the beta version of Skype Translator is going to relate to the Skype that we're using like right now. Microsoft seems to be throwing a good deal of resources behind its real-time translation efforts. So we'll be keeping an eye on that one so that then I can do the show in Russian and you'll still get it in English. No, I'm kidding. Flicted knows Russian. So then we could have him speak through a translator and get that Google Translate goodness where it comes up with the clever – where you can get all the clever, weird – construction of phrases that you've been waiting for. Let's see, now another stuff. So there's Skype, there's now Apple things for a bit. You know, it's been sort of quiet and the rumor mills have not been rumoring much except kind of obvious stuff that you know, big iPhone, little iPhone, what, you know, what's the new iPhone going to be? Apparently there's a whole bunch of prototype projects that have been found. Jefferies analyst Peter Misek suggests the prototypes are, quote, floating around, unquote, in the Asian supply chains. He did a research note to investors and described several prototype products, including an ITV with 4K. You've heard us talk about what 4K is, right? You know, that's double in both directions the pixels of HD. So it's the, you know, it's like four HD screens all put into one. Gesture control, so like stuff like, you know, like Microsoft's Kinect, voice control, along with an ARM-based touchscreen MacBook Air, that's interesting, and an OLED iPhone that unfolds into an iPad mini. Quote, in contrast to investors' fears, the supply chain thinks Apple's innovation may be accelerating. With more than the usual number of prototypes floating around, there were the highlights. The list that I gave you, they're also talking about smartwatch prototypes with a curved bangle type and curved screen, wearables including healthcare appliances, and payment authentication modules. Some of them, you know, obviously the sound like stuff we've heard before. Some of them, like the folding iPhone, are almost unbelievable. I mean, that would be a Steve Jobsian level something else to announce that one. Apple's been rumored to be working on Apple television set prototypes and experimenting with ARM-based Macs. It's unclear if any of these products will make it out of the prototype stage. And just before you get too excited about all the stuff, this Peter Misek, the analyst who said this, has been frequently incorrect with his predictions, but occasionally gets it accurate. He was one of the first ones to point towards early iPhone 6 prototypes in a 4.8-inch size, but he also incorrectly predicted several elements of the iPhone 5S and has talked about an Apple ITV for a long time. He previously suggested that Apple planned to merge iOS and OS X, which was not true. And he also had predicted Apple signed deals to create an iTunes Netflix competitor, which also didn't happen. So we'll see what happens. You know, Apple, on one that did happen, this ain't rumors, Apple did buy Beats Electronics headphones. And so Dr. Dre going to be working for Apple. So I don't know what that means, but it was specifically mentioned that that Dre would be and Jimmy Iovine, who's also involved with Beats, would be going to work at Apple. And so there's some thought that you know, there's sort of two pieces to this. One is for Apple to get their hands on a brand that's successful and similar to Apple, but also that this may be give them inroads with some of the personnel at Beats into some new areas that they haven't been in before. Just in case the new model stuff, I for different laptops or desktops or whatever, unless there seems to be something really big coming, we don't tend to report it much on the info shop. But there is if you're looking to buy an iMac, like a brand new iMac pretty soon, you may want to wait a few weeks. It's worth the gamble to wait a few weeks, because either if this rumor, if this one piece is true, then you either can get what you already wanted to get that you would buy, you know, next week for less money because the new stuff will be out, or you might get better models with better specs for the same money as your budget is currently. So might be a reason to hold on if you're looking for an iMac. Basically pointing around the internals of the OS X Mavericks developer beta that was just released, Apple fan Pike spotted references up to 3 heretofore unseen iMacs. A 21.5-inch, let's see, and then a it looks like a couple of 21.5-inch, and then one with a 27-inch. And so the labeling was different. You know, you don't need to know the difference. It's just they use different numbers that show kind of a revision. So there's, you know, you don't get lots in the way of specs or any of that, but clearly, and it's not a shocker that there would be, you know, that at some point they're going to release some new iMacs. Oh, one of the things is once the news about the iMac listing started to spread around, that particular beta got pulled. That's according to 9to5Mac. So if Apple has 3 new iMacs tucked up its sleeve, they probably won't be hidden up there for long, because WWDC, where Apple generally announces things like this, is coming in 5 days. So there should be some more announcements coming from that front. If there is any, you know, and obviously we'll cover them as we hear about them. But so, you know, it's one of those things where, just in case you're out there listening and you were about to buy an iMac, you may want to chill for just a little bit longer if you can get away with it. And then a couple of new concept things, and they're not related to each other, but they could be fascinating in the long term if they happen, and putting them together. Solar roadways have been kind of in the news. And you think about it, there's all that pavement out there, you know, roads, highways, avenues, bike paths, sidewalks, and parking lots for transportation, but they could do more things. And imagine if you made all of them into a source for renewable energy, like, you know, if they were a location for solar panels. For instance, if you could make the road out of solar panels, you'd have it covering so much territory, ultimately, by some estimates, producing enough electricity to power our nation 3 times over. And there's more. You could put programmable LEDs into the road that would send information to drivers while eliminating the need for painted road markers. So, for instance, if you needed to close a lane, you could make the LEDs mark the lane and, you know, move people over in just about real time. Let's see. The other thing would be you could build in heat sources that would make snowy and icy roads a thing of the past. You know, it sounds kind of futuristic, but geez, you know what? There hasn't been enough futuristic stuff being announced that was kind of – that had any possibility of happening. So while this sounds like, you know, one of those way, way out there things, they have received funding from federal highway authorities, the company called Solar Roadways, to begin pilot programs. So this could be closer than we ever thought possible. This could be – it sounds like some of the obstacles to using to making roads solar – have gone away. And then this one is not related, but if you put them together, it's kind of fascinating. Google's moving forward with making a big step in their self-driving car project. They've now started building their own prototype vehicles from scratch rather than retrofitting existing commercial models like the Toyota Prius is what they did before. So the new concepts, they look kind of – they're pretty pod-like. They're sort of two-person pods. The thing that's fascinating is what they don't have. They don't have a steering wheel. They don't have a brake pedal or a gas pedal. They just have a stop-and-go button and like basically a kind of pull-over right now button as far as the controls go. Google is quick to point out that the 3 prototypes it's currently using are test models designed for observing, learning, and eventual tweaking, not necessarily for style and creature comforts, although they do have a smile on the front of the pods. Let's see. As always, improved road safety is the driving factor behind the project, and the prototype designs are Spartan, so the project team can focus on specific details. According to project director Chris Urmson, quote, "It was inspiring to start with a blank sheet of paper and ask what should be different about this kind of vehicle. They look like existing compact cars, kind of, but again, no steering wheel, accelerator, or brake. They have an electric motor. They also have a screen to show the route that you're going. An electric motor, two seats, seat belt, and some storage, and that's it, you know, as far as what deals with the people. Obviously, the prototypes also have onboard sensors, cameras, and radars. They can detect objects to a distance of 2 football fields away. Their speed has been capped at 25 miles per hour for now while they're testing." Urmson went on to reveal that the team is planning to build about 100 prototypes of the self-driving cars to test out different features. And while the current models, they don't, you know, obviously you can only basically tell it to stop or go or pull over. The test drivers will begin trialing prototypes with some opt-in manual controls in case of emergencies. They're going to build a small run pilot program if all goes well in the next couple of years somewhere in California and learn from that experience. And if the technology develops as we hope, according to Urmson, we'll work with partners to bring this technology into the world safely. There is a Google Plus page for the project, and they are keen to hear feedback about which features passengers want from their future self-driving car. So that's one of those things. It sounds like a pretty big step coming, and it should be fascinating to see what happens with that. So that is the Technology Bytes InfoShot news, and I'm Peter Hughes.
Sorry to make you jump into the news so fast.
That's okay. I just hadn't opened them all into tabs and organized them into the order. Usually I get that done right before. And I hadn't finished.
Okay, well. Wow, let's see. Okay.
I'm hoping that the Google car, they make it so, because if it's electric, it doesn't make any sound, and they, you know, they worry about that with blind people and stuff. And so since it's just got a start and go button and it drives itself, I hope they make it make the Jetson sound, car sound, whenever it goes.
We'll probably have to pay for it in auto tone.
Oh, y'all moved mics.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes, we did.
Fixed it.
Well, Groovehouse kind of like, you know, shame me.
No.
He's the house mom now. He's like keeping everything in line.
I made a mess, Groovehouse. You have to vacuum. You need a towel.
Can I have a drink of water?
Don't make Jay turn this radio show around.
Don't lick a napkin with your spit and try to clean our faces.
Again. Wow. It's Groovehouse Mom.
Groovehousekeeper.
Groovehousekeeper. That was the best. Barrett did that on IRC. That was the best.
Just trying to keep things up around here, you know? I mean, trying to help out.
I was trying to make it look lived.
Right.
Well, I think Peter fell over.
Knocked me over with a feather. No, I moved my keyboard off the
feather
off
duster.
I was moving my keyboard off the tabletop so that I could type without it doing the kind of thumping and banging that you apparently can hear through the mic when it's on the top of the desk.
All right. Well, the phone number here is 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight. We are taking your calls, and we'll be doing so for the next hour and 37 minutes. What are you shaking your head at? Like the Groovehouse? Did you do it again? What are you doing?
I'm doing nothing.
I think he's like doing some laundry for Afflicted right now. It looks like something's going on.
All right.
Someone. Peter, look behind you. There's someone in the room.
Oh, good Lord. All right.
Yeah, it sounds like Peter's got a night job as a Foley artist.
Look at them coconuts.
That's twice that a Foley artist has come up in conversation for me in the last week.
Huh.
Yeah.
Were they both with me?
No.
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 But
both times they utilized the horse clopping noises.
Well, that's because you can do that with kind of nothing else. If I had a piece of celery, then I could do the like bone cracking, breaking stuff kind of sound.
Yeah, let's not do that. That sounds bad. For those not the No Foley artists, weren't they the people that actually did like all the different sound effects for the movies?
Still are.
Not did. They still do. If you look, it's credited on every movie.
A lot of movies where you think the sounds are natural or actually being recorded have been dubbed over with, you know, chopping up lettuce.
The funny thing is also you can buy, like, in Hollywood, they have them on, like license. Like some companies, like studios, will have like certain artists or certain sounds like in their files, and so if a movie wants to have certain sounds, they don't have to actually make somebody do it. They can go find it in the library of Foley sounds that studio owns.
Remember finding out when I was
How many of you are familiar with the
Wilhelm scream?
The Wilhelm scream.
Yeah, they love. That's funny because it used to get put in places. And nobody really talked about it, but then maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I remember reading an article and people mentioned that it was in 6 or 7 things. It's in Star Wars.
It's in there's a YouTube montage of all of them.
Well, because it's become very popular, especially after that. Like suddenly, everybody started putting it in everything, and now I hear it like. In most movies, I end up hearing it at some point in the movie.
There, now it's in there. It's on purpose.
Yeah.
It's put in there as a kind of a shout out because I've seen it in places in movies where it really wasn't. You know, most of the time it's real subtle and so it's appropriate. But I've seen it in places where it was a lot more than was called for from whatever was going on. Foley wise,
Disney movies, they use it.
I was upset to find out that a lot of like the documentaries, when they put like, you know, the National Geographic stuff, and they'll put cameras under the ground and you'll see like the little, you know, family of hedgehogs, whatever, living and doing little things. All that's fake sound, I guess, because they don't have mics. You can't really hear stuff like that. But they've got guys, you know, doing little footsteps and all that stuff. You think it's documentary. Oh, that's what hedgehogs sound like. No, it's a guy with, you know, some celery and some newspaper and a tin can.
They use a. They'll use like a box of sand or leaves when people are walking, and they'll like watch the movie and make the walking sounds when they're walking. Or they'll have bricks. They'll like, I remember watching like they use bricks to make when like stones are like falling, which is sometimes why the stones sound horribly fake because it sounds like because it's actually bricks.
I think they should just use slide whistles for everything.
Yes.
Drum kit.
That's
Peter. Are you doing Foley stuff?
Drumming on something.
He's playing those plastic bucket drums that you see the street peddlers do.
No, it's a Bluetooth keyboard. It's all. It's just I think this mic, for whatever reason, is really good at picking up the sound of the keys, awesome. The pressing of the keys.
All right. Well, it does look like
and doors creaking.
That sounds like a Halloween soundtrack.
That's my office is in like an upstairs kind of game room, and I have kids who, after, you know, since it's only been for their entire freaking lives that been doing a radio show on Wednesday nights, they just still don't really think about it, and so they go bombing around here when.
It's seeing me sitting on the here radio in front of a microphone all my life.
With my headphones on apparently is not enough of a hint. So they go slamming around the doors or coming in and talking to me. Fortunately, none of them have talked loud enough to where you guys could hear it before I could mute, but it's happened.
All right. Little behind-the-scenes information there from the Technology Bites family.
It's like the Foley part of Technology Bites.
All right. Groove House.
Yes.
I see that we have a... call in the queue.
Yes, we do.
Who is it?
All right, up first on the show, we are going to speak with Dave.
Dave, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
How y'all doing?
Good. What can we do for you?
Get me on the internet.
Get you on the internet?
Yes, sir.
Well, what seems to be the problem with getting on the internet?
I try to get a connection there. It's Windows 7 desktop. Got a message on there. It says local area connection does not make a valid IPC configuration.
Who provides your internet?
Unfortunately, AT&T.
Okay, what kind of internet do you have from AT&T?
DSL. Oh, yeah, UVerse, sorry.
You have UVerse. Do you have, is the computer trying to connect, you're connecting it with an Ethernet cable?
10-4, I mean, yes.
Okay, 10-4 is fine. So you've got that, an Ethernet cable going from the computer to, do you have a router, or do you
directly
just...
directly to the router.
All right.
I can get on a MacBook, I can get on it via Wi-Fi, I can get on my cell phone via Wi-Fi.
I don't know how far Jay can get with the 10 code, so you might just stick the 10-4.
Roger.
I had a CB.
Do you know the 10 codes?
I know some of them. 1020 was like location.
1098.
9.
Don't know that one.
No, the 1036 is time.
1098 is mental subject.
All right. So, anyway, it's a desktop computer with an Ethernet card in it. Is this a new computer?
Yeah, pretty much. It's new to me.
No. Is it a new computer? I mean, so the reason I asked you that was like, is it a computer that you just scavenged somewhere or somebody gave you or something like that?
No, I bought it from a guy that rebuilt them about 3 months ago. It's been working fine up until this morning.
Was it working on your home network and stuff fine?
Oh, yeah. I had it for about 3 months. It just happened. It happened when I got off from work today.
I hate to ask the obvious question, but have you rebooted?
I came in and it said the computer didn't shut down properly, and I'm thinking I shut it down last night.
Okay.
But when I got up this morning, the UVerse, it wasn't connected, and there was a red light blinking on the router. I didn't fool with it. I think my kids might have reset it or something, and all that stuff is working. But when I came to turn the computer on, it said shut down, and then I restarted, and it said it was trying to do some kind of correction or something, and then it finally corrected itself, but now it won't get on the internet.
Jay, could it be weather related?
Well, do your other computers get on the internet?
Yeah. So my Mac gets on there, and my cell phone.
And they're working currently? I mean, today?
Yes.
All right. And what is the actual message that
you're local area connection does not have a valid IP configuration.
I'm going to just Google that because that might be the easiest. Local area does not have a valid IP configuration. So it what it sounds like right off the top of my head is almost like you have got some kind of hard-coded an IP address in there, but chances are if you had done that, you would know what that was or know that you had done that. So have you gone in and messed with any of your TCP/IP settings?
No.
Let's see. Found
it. I don't even know what it is.
Okay, that's what I had a feeling that was the case, but, you know, I thought I'd give you the benefit of the doubt. It looks like wired network connection unavailable when booting Windows 7 from shutdown state. Finally thought it was the Asus. It looks like it's going to take a little bit of research to figure out what's causing that, but since you have computers that can connect to the Internet, then you might want to do a search on that error message. I found a page that talks about it might be the drivers for your network card. So you might want to try, you know, using one of your working computers. Do you know, is the computer that you bought from your friend, is it a name brand?
Yeah, it's an HP.
Okay, so you can go to HP's support site and get the latest driver for the network card that's installed in there. I'm looking to see if I can find anything else. But it looks like it could be, it looks like it's going to take a little effort to figure it out. There's not like a quick fix for it.
I was hoping it was something I should clicked on and then it would have just magically reappeared or something.
Well, you know, I appreciate that, you know, that people think that can happen. And sometimes it can, but the way this is reading, at least what I'm seeing, is that it could be, it could be related to either the network card itself or the network drivers. What are you finding, Barry?
And given that he got a message that it didn't shut down properly, then you wonder that Yeah, you wonder, was there a problem when it was interacting with the drivers when it was trying to shut down?
Reboot it again. If this happens when it just kind of hangs and it comes back and it says, hey, you didn't have a clean shutdown last time, you don't have any network, and then you reboot and it comes back up and you've got the network, other people are experiencing that, and they're saying that it could be the Bonjour DNS responder service could be to blame. They shut that service off and everything just works. That's kind of what's hanging. But try rebooting and just see if all the networking comes back up after a clean reboot.
Yeah, like what Barrett's saying is, you know, rather than having come to your computer, see that it might not have shut down properly or it may have restarted on its own but didn't do it cleanly, if you can actually push it through a clean restart, so, you know, shut down all your open applications and then click on start and then restart and have it shut down. You know, I'd also run Windows Update. Well, you won't be able to do that because you're not online. But, you know, just try a clean reboot and see if it comes back to a stable state, and then it might go ahead and connect to the network.
I did it about four times.
Oh, okay. You didn't mention that.
You didn't mention that. Okay. That's why I asked you if you had done that, but you told me that the answer that you gave me to my question was that you had come back and it had restarted it, but it had a problem. So
I did reboot it several times.
Okay, so it did cleanly restart?
Yeah, it did cleanly restart. That's correct. I'm rebooting it again as we're speaking.
Have you looked to see how it shows up in the device manager?
No.
To see if there's anything odd in the device manager list, like an extra network interface or anything that maybe shouldn't be there.
Did you make any changes to your router?
No.
Have you rebooted your router?
The kids might have done that when I left this morning. That's possible.
But they might have rebooted it?
Yes, that's
so
possible.
The answer to my question is no, you have not rebooted the router. You think it might or might not have. We don't know. It exists in a Schrodinger's cat kind of state where it could have either been rebooted or it wasn't rebooted. If you don't know, I would say at least it's worth a shot. Try it. You know, I mean, the reason I'm asking these questions is because I think these are things that might help.
Okay.
So if you cannot tell me that they have been done, then do it. So try rebooting the router. You tell me that the computer's been rebooted. Some of the stuff that I'm reading is indicating that there might be an issue with the router. It really could be a lot of things. So what I'm going to ask you to do is I'm going to ask you to take that error message, plug it into your favorite search engine, and start reading and see if you can find anything that speaks definitively to the problem. It comes up, and there are thousands of responses, 218,000 results to search on the term local area connection does not have valid IP configuration. So it is not an uncommon problem. Okay. What I have not found is a definitive fix for it in all the stuff that I've read. And I don't have time or, you know, it doesn't make good radio for me to kind of research Google to find the answer to this. But I'll tell you that it's out there. It looks like the answer is out there. So if you read through, try stuff that makes sense. A lot of people are talking about unplug your modem and router, turn your computer off for a little while, then plug the modem and the router back on, and then turn the computer back on and see what happens. Something is going on with, and hopefully it's not just a bad computer. Since we don't know the history of the computer, the history of the software install, I mean, it could certainly be something like that.
Or there's this page says, tell people that you rebuild computers and sell it to somebody else. I'm kidding.
Bad joke at this time.
And some say that that DHCP may not be enabled on your wired connections, so you could go into your TCP/IP settings. And let me see if I have Windows available to me to look at a TCP/IP settings. You can. It's Windows 7, you say?
Correct.
If you email me, I'll send you some instructions. And I just can't solve it on the air for that one. It looks like there's a ton of different things it could be. I don't think it's WinSock messed up with malware, but it's possible. Somebody on IRCPC guy suggests that it could possibly be malware, but I haven't seen that. It's sounding like it's not getting a valid. It's either trying to negotiate with the router to get an IP address and a net mask, and it's failing because it's asking for something that's outside of what the router's prepared to give it. So like if you were to take, but I've never seen a message like that. If you misconfigure your TCP/IP settings, usually it'll just fail to route. But if the router's handing it an IP address that's not any good, or a route that's no good, that could account for the error. But I would say, reboot the router, reboot the computer, and if that doesn't work, go online, take that error message and search for it. Like I said, there's tons of people writing, you know, that they're having that issue, and lots of people throwing suggestions at them, and you might find a fix in there. 713-526-5738 is the number to call. 713-526-KPFT if you want to be on the air with us tonight. I'm looking, so yeah, you know, like I found the thing Barrett was talking about with the Bonjour ID strings. And some of it's a little convoluted. It may not be easy to sort. It's also possible, from what I'm reading, that you just have a bad network card. And network cards are relatively cheap to replace. You can buy a, you can even buy a USB dongle, Wi-Fi dongle, for the computer and have it connect to your Wi-Fi network and do it that way. That also might be an option for you, since you save so much money buying a used computer. And you could use some of those savings and buy a $20 USB air card. All right. Well, all the lines are open here on Technology Bites. If you want to be on the air with us tonight, you can dial 713-526-5738. I'm going to consult the brain trust of the IRC. And, yeah, okay. So somebody's suggesting an IP config release all and IP config renew, but you kind of IP config renew every time you reboot the computer.
Yeah, I don't think it's getting that far. I think it's having a hard time grabbing the device.
Yeah, it sounds like it's talking to the router and saying, I want this IP configuration, and the router's saying no. So, but if he didn't make any changes to it, it's hard to say why that would happen spontaneously.
Maybe the computer's asking for something, 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 .256.
Hmm. Something, 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 .256.
Yeah.
Can't do it.
Won't do it.
Because it's 255 is the highest you can go.
Yeah.
800. All right. All the lines are open.
Sounds like something's burning.
What
in
is
here.
Burning?
Like
what is that
fire?
Smell?
I think Groovehouse started it with the vacuum.
Is it the vacuum? Was the, is the motor on the vacuum burning up?
That was the vacuum sucking up all the crumbs from Flickid's pastry that burned inside there.
Toast?
No, I think Smiling Bob's in the house making.
Oh, that's Smiling Bob.
Okay.
Jeez.
He's grilling. Oof.
He might be grilling something in the back.
I'm gonna start calling him Smelling Bob.
Smelling Bob. Oh, PC guy on IRC says it could be the network cable could be flaky.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't,
I've seen people think that network cables stretch. What, they don't?
They'll stretch to a certain limit.
All right.
I'm assuming he checked his link light and made sure he had actual connection lights in the back of his network card.
It wouldn't come up with that error if you were booting the computer up and trying to go online. If you had no network connection, it just would. It seems to me it just wouldn't work. What I've experienced with Windows is every time I've had somebody fail to plug a network cable into their computer, or they plugged into a bad port.
Or,
yeah, it'll come up with the 169.257 address. 256 address, because I only want to be one off. All right, well, all the lines are open. It's not fundraiser, so 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us. We are taking Groovehouse will be taking your cleaning suggestions, how to get the smell out, how to get the pastry smell out of your Hoover. And that's not euphemism, so
Hoover. 1071.
Are you,
advise nature of fire. I'm into the 10 codes now.
Okay.
Was I right? I was right about 1098, right?
1098 is actually prison jailbreak. But I'm looking
at
1099? Wanted, stolen, indicated.
1099, that's what you get when you
it's,
work.
Self-employed.
Self-employed.
Huh, maybe that's a different 10 code.
Yeah, I'm looking at, these are international police or local, it's Association of Public Communications Officers, so that might not be the exact.
Or maybe it changed
after
25 years.
Possibly, yeah, I don't know.
Which one is, what's to request a smoky report?
1073, smoke report.
It's not the same thing.
Smoke them if you got them.
Smoke report? Like they report smoke? Smoke is report? No, smoky.
I get that. Like
I don't think there's
and the bandit.
I don't think there's a tin code for that.
You're looking for CB codes.
Yeah, you're CB looking codes. For CB.
Call Red Sovine.
Come on back and talk to Teddy Bear.
Man, the last season of Archer where they went off, they had the one episode that was the Smokey and the Bandit episode, and it had the Trans Am and the mustache, and
nice.
It was nice.
You know, Smokey and the Bandit's a really good movie.
Smokey and the Bandit?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'd seen it before, but I just watched it again maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and it's obviously dated, but it holds up as far as it's really funny. It's a good movie.
Nice.
Are you going to re-watch the sequels, too?
I don't know if I ever watched the sequels.
That may be why you can circle back and still enjoy the first one again.
I probably saw Smokey and the Bandit 2, though.
They got progressively crappier. They ended up making one without – Burt Reynolds wasn't even in it.
That was Smokey and the Bandit versus Godzilla, right?
Wow, I'm reading this one possible solution to the problem, and the flow control option was switched back to TX and RX on his network card. Man, it could be a fairly convoluted fix to get to it.
He could just rip out the drivers for the network card and reinstall it.
That's what I was saying. If he goes to the HP website and gets the latest drivers for it and reinstalls them, that might sort it. All right, well, we got a couple of calls coming in on the phone line. 713-526-5738 is the number to call if you want to be on the air with us. We are taking calls here tonight. And, you know, technology bites. Just keeping up with the social media here. If you're on Twitter, you can go to geekradio.com, and in the right-hand column, all of our Twitter accounts are presented there. You can follow along if you like. Some of us tend to post things now and again to the worldwide Twitter webs. 713-526-5738. We've got two calls coming in and four lines. Looks like maybe four lines open, so if you want to be on the air. No? Well, okay. Groove House is giving me the hand sign.
Give me the 10 something code.
I'll give you the
10, you're number one.
I think actually is a code for that 1061 or something.
You're just guessing.
It's in the 60s, I think.
10-4, good buddy. All right, Groove House.
All right. Next up on the show,
we're Russian roulette.
Little Russian roulette with Ray.
Ray, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Okay, I had an old computer, and I was using Outlook for the email.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got a new computer, and didn't think anything one way or the other, and it had Windows Live for the mail.
Right.
Okay, for some reason, when I file an email, it comes out Outlook. And Windows Live will not open the Outlook file.
What do you mean file an email?
Well, save it.
So when you're using Windows Live Mail, and you're actually saving one of your messages?
That's right, for future reference. What? Then I go back to open it up, and I can't. And so it says, would you like to search the internet for a way to open the email? Yes, I would. Punch the button, and it comes out, install Outlook.
It's probably a .eml file is what it's being saved as, or something like that, or .mht, and then it's opening it back up. And
why? Let me ask you this. Why do you save the mail as a file instead of maybe just storing it in a folder or something right there inside of your mail program to access it?
Stupidity.
it's not a very common practice, although there are reasons to do this, but it's not a very common practice to take a message and actually save it as a separate file outside of your mail program, unless you're wanting to share that message with I don't know why you'd do it really, but I've seen it done where so you could send a message to somebody so they could actually see what the headers of the message for some troubleshooting. But most people, when they manage their email, they just keep it inside their mail program. And if they want to organize it, they create folders, you know, on the, you know, along with they have their inbox.
Well,
and
I do have some folders.
Well, and you put the message there. But if you're wanting to save it and then open it up later inside of the same email program, that just doesn't really make a lot of sense. But there's probably has to do with the way that you're saving the message. And I don't have a Windows Live Mail in front of me, but when you save that message, you probably have a number of different options of how you want to save it. And you want to make sure you're choosing a format that Windows Live Mail can understand. It's usually .msg or .eml, but I'm not positive on that. Let's see if I have Windows
now,
Live
Mail. Are you saving them so you can look at them later? Or are you more or less, you want to back them up in case you accidentally erase something and you want to have a backup of those?
I just want to have them so, for future reference, yes.
Okay, so kind of a backup. There is a way that you can go into Windows Live, the mail, and with a few clicks you can download all of your email messages into a single folder. That way, in case you ever lost anything, you could go up and you could back it up from there.
Okay, on Windows Live, I have an email, and I would like to... shit, it's not on there. Open, print, reply, forward. Somehow or another. Save as a file.
Do you see that?
Okay, now, when it says save as a file, it comes up libraries, documents, and it has a file name and save as type.
Yeah, and what's the type that it wants to save?
Okay, the normal type comes up as mail. And in parentheses is a star dot EML in parentheses, not parentheses.
That's fine. It's star.
That's right.
So what are your other options if you touch, if you click on that drop?
Then you could file it as a text file, a Unicode text file, HTML file.
Okay. If you save it as a text file, then when you go back to look at it again, it'll open up in any text editor like
Notepad
or WordPad or any of those. You might try saving it in that format.
Okay.
Or if you save it as
email has formatting and pictures and stuff.
If you save it as HTML,
it'll open up in a web browser.
Yeah, when you double click it, it'll open up in a web browser along with, you know, someone puts a put a picture in there, you made a big font or you know, changed the color.
Now it should, if you save it as an EML file, it should open up in Windows Live Mail. Are you sure?
No, because here's the deal. What you're doing is you're downloading a file from like a web services. And then you get it locally, and then unless you've got like a web services client that knows how to talk to that server, it's not going to know to associate what he downloaded with that original message. I mean, there's no way to get it back up in there.
When I use Outlook, and I cannot remember what format it saves it as, but if you save a message in Outlook as a file, I can then attach it to an email and email it to you, and if you double-click, it'll open up inside of your mail program.
Oh, yeah. You could do that, but you can't just double-click on it and have it like open up in Windows Live Mail, though. I don't believe.
You don't think so?
No.
Well, let me ask another question. Every time this happens, it wants to install Outlook 8.
Yeah, even if
I'm not trying to open something, when I open the email, when it's live, the thing comes up, would you like to install Outlook 8? Yes or no?
I don't know where that's coming from, because if you have Windows Live Mail, that should be, you know, your mail program, unless you have, I don't know where the Outlook 8, I don't even know what Outlook 8 is, to tell you the truth, because Outlook comes with Office 2010, 2013, possibly 2007, but I don't know.
I got 2010.
You have Office 2010?
Yes.
All right, so you probably have Outlook on there. So you could conceivably get away from Windows Live Mail and just use Outlook if that's the program that you're more familiar with.
Well, in the Windows Live, I didn't really have any problem until I the old email on the old computer that I had saved.
Yeah, you're trying
to open that stuff, and it wouldn't work.
Oh, okay, so you're trying to open up messages that you saved on your old computer on the new computer.
That's right.
Okay, you saved those in Outlook, and that's why they're wanting to find Outlook and use that to open them again.
Well, is there a problem having Outlook and Windows Live both?
No, there's not a problem with that. You just have to remember which program has what mail messages in it. But you could install Outlook. If you have the software, you can install it and use that as your mail program, and it will import all of your mail from Windows Live Mail and become your default mail program, so you could use that. So I would consider that if you have the program, if you have the Office suite available to you, Outlook is a much better mail program than Windows Live Mail. You already know how to use it because you've used it before, and it would manage all of your current email archives. You'd be able to read those, and you'd be able to use it the way you always have.
Mm-hmm.
So I would consider that as an option.
Okay.
All right?
All right, then. I do thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for your call tonight.
Okay, though. Bye-bye. All right.
Yeah, one of the sad things, I was hoping that Windows 8 had maybe, you know, stolen the print to PDF type feature like the Mac OS has had forever now, because then he could just print whatever he wanted to save to PDF, and then he'd be able to open it and look at it in any number of things. But sadly, you have to buy software to make that work on Windows.
Well, the unfortunate thing is that he's typical of many people who use computers, and I'm not saying this is a derogatory thing, but they come up with a way that they don't know that it's not a non-standard solution.
Right.
You know? So,
well, he's treating each email as a document.
Right.
It's like a Word doc where he could save it out somewhere and then, you know, read it
instead
else.
Of treating his email like an overall archive of all of his messages. I mean, I've got email archives that go all the way back to 1993, but I keep it all in my mail archive, and I use the mail program of the day to manage that mail, import the mail. But so, you know, it's a little convoluted, but it sounds like he has a way out. All right, well, judging by, or you can tell by the music, that lovely, lovely background music, that it's time for us to take a much needed. You know, when you do that, you just kind of jam the slider towards me. Your hand comes towards me.
You just scared someone off the road.
It's the Hotel California.
You can. I'm sorry, Hank. We're going to have you hold while we do some station business here. So hang on there, and we'll get you in the second hour of the show. If you want to be on the air, 713-526-5738. You are listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Ruhal.
Keeper.
Usted probablemente ha estado en su carro buscando por coberturas de noticias o buscando alguna música nueva. O a lo mejor usted estuvo en su casa cambiando el cuadrante buscando algo diferente. Su radio probablemente se haya quedado en KPFT y permanecido allí. Si usted es un nuevo radioescucha de esta estación, esta es la manera en que la radio de la comunidad trabaja. Nosotros dependemos de radioescuchas, no de comerciantes, para obtener dinero que usamos para la operación de nuestra estación. Nosotros tenemos campañas de donaciones pocas veces al año, donde nosotros le pedimos a usted que apoye nuestro trabajo con una donación monetaria. Usted ha venido dependiendo de nosotros, pero nosotros dependemos de usted. Vaya a la página de internet www.kpft.org para hacer su donación monetaria. Esta es libre de comerciales, patrocinada por Radio Escuchas. Radio Pacífica, KPFT, Houston.
Did you know you can find KPFT on the social networking sites Twitter and Facebook? You certainly can, and we'd love you to add us as a friend and get us connected with friends of yours. Join our fan page and check out a special video message from General Manager Dwayne Bradley, as well as keep up with KPFT programmers and staff. Visit facebook.com/KPFT Houston to join us. To follow us, visit twitter.com/KPFT. With both, you can link up with other KPFT listeners, get the latest news about the station, and find lots of extras. It's fun, so catch up with KPFT online. Again, on Twitter, visit twitter.com/KPFT. On Facebook, visit us at facebook.com/KPFT Houston. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Hey, Barrett, what's happening?
I don't know.
Well, room around town.
Interrupt this skit to bring you
Barrett time! Barrett time! Barrett time!
Yeah. That means it's time for
Barrett time!
Yeah. Anyway, take it away, Barrett.
All right. First of all, happy birthday, Mom. I'm not playing favorites. She's now a supporter of the station, and she is my mom. We've also got another birthday of sorts tonight. It's fairly obscure, but I'll put it out there anyway. Does anyone want to take a guess? Famous computer birthday? No, I had to look this one up, but we can back it up a bit. What about the father of computing, as a hint? Do you even know who the father of computing is?
Babbage.
Yeah, I figured Babbage is what most people say. It's Turing. It's Turing. Because on this day in 1936, we can argue it, but on this day in 1936, Alan Turing submitted his paper on computable numbers, which many would argue laid down the framework for modern computer science. In the paper, he states, according to my definition, a number is computable if its decimal can be written down by a machine. And in the first section of the paper, he describes a machine that is supplied with a paper tape running through it, divided into sections called squares, each capable of bearing a symbol. The machine could read one square while remembering the last square, and it had the equivalent of one register, but was in fact a working computer, the first able to accept instructions as well as data through the tape. So, you know, I argue towards that. That's someone who got it right. Any guesses as to someone who got it mostly right in 1959, same day in history, today?
No.
In 1959, a government committee led by Rear Admiral Grace Hopper met to lay out the foundations of a common business-oriented computer language named COBOL. It was this committee's short-sightedness that directly led to the Y2K bug by having an implied century in the data type, so just two-digit year. And as luck would have it, Grace Hopper also coined the term bug when she found a moth causing a malfunction in one of the mainframes. So the first and quite possibly the biggest bugs just for her. And lastly, more trivia, this time a bit of space trivia. 40 years ago, someone put something into space that would eventually become the first spacecraft to land on Mars some 5 months later. Flicted from probably guess the who. They make good yogurt. This is the Russians. I bet KD5 could get this. So yeah, so 43 years ago today, the Russians launched the Mars 3 unmanned space probe just 9 days after its twin spacecraft, the Mars 2, was launched with the same mission. Mars 2 made it into the red planet, but it crashed, landed on the surface. Mars 3 actually made it into the planet. Yeah, made it into the atmosphere and did not slow down, didn't do anything. There were some mitigating circumstances, but yeah, crashed on the surface. Mars 3 had better luck and nailed a soft landing. And just to show you how close this race was, our own, the U.S.'s own Mariner 9, reached Martian orbit just 2 weeks prior to the Russian probes, becoming the first spacecraft to orbit the planet. So when everyone showed up, you really couldn't see much due to the large dust storms covering the planet. Those eventually settled down, but not before taking out Mars 2. So that's probably why Mars 2 didn't make it. They went down just a little too early. Anyway, that's it for your interplanetary info shot. Sorry, Pete. And that's that for Barrett time.
All right, 713-526-5738. I see that we had some people call in during the break and get in the queue, so that's very good. Three calls on the line, and plenty of open lines and plenty of time left as we enter our second hour of broadcast for Technology Bites. Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who do we have up?
All right, up next on the second half of the show, we're going to kick it off with Hank.
Hank, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
The second hour, that's kind of like putting me on HD3, isn't it? I am on HD3. Okay. I have Windows 8. Hate it.
Okay, thanks for your call.
8 or 8.1.
Have you?
I hate all Windows 8.
Have you updated it to 8.1?
No, I haven't updated to 8.1 yet.
Okay, I would recommend that you do that. It'll make the hate partially go away.
Okay.
All right, so you hate Windows 8.1. You called in. We had it on hold to tell us that. So
yeah.
What are you looking for?
I want Windows 3.1.1.
You can get
bulletproof, did everything these do.
Yeah, it does everything Windows 8 does. Holy sure it does.
Just like a zombie.
27 ways to do it.
All right, so, but seriously, folks, what are you looking for?
Well, really, I'm kind of looking for a way to make it easier to use. I don't like the Google-style panel that they have on the face of it.
There's actually a couple of videos that, if you search for them on YouTube, where a couple of people talk about how to use Windows 8, and because the thing is, it really is not intuitive based on anybody's use of anything that came before it. And I actually have not used Windows 8 that much, but I've watched people use it, and I couldn't figure out how to do things because it's really they're trying to combine a desktop and a tablet OS into one thing, and unfortunately to me it's the desktop that suffers because of not good functionality for something with a screen that you don't touch but a mouse that you move. But there's a couple of videos and they're like 15, 20, maybe 25 minutes long that talk about things that once you know them, it makes it way easier to use and it actually becomes functional. And I don't remember off the top of my head. One of them is that is not using the tile screens, but instead dropping into the search menu and to start typing for the program that you want to use because it'll autocomplete the program name. And
that's
they'll
one of the things I really like.
They'll
like,
show up and they'll disappear as you type until you get down to what you want. That's one trick that helps a lot than trying to find it all in the tiles and going through like
right. Let me clarify that point too. Right, while we're talking about, so if you swipe out and you get your little search charm there and you click on search and you type whatever, you type Internet Explorer or you type in the name of the program.
I'm just thinking of somebody who like was using like Windows XP or something.
Yeah.
And your beginning of your explanation is, if you just ignore the tiles and get the search charm, and they're like, am I playing a video game?
I know, but you've already, the caller already has Windows 8.
I know, it's just the term, they're all new terms.
They're new
so
terms,
funny.
Right. Well, you got to have to embrace the change because that's the nature of technology. But, like Plickton was saying, that one tip is really actually very useful. So once you bring out, you know, the charms that come up on the right-hand side that have your search and all that,
yeah,
you can start typing in whatever you need, and you get, you know, whatever program you're going to use, whether it's your email program or whatever. Once you learn how to populate those tiles on the front page, though, it's not so bad. You get rid of all the clutter that they put on there, and you figure out how to put your tiles in. It's just like a big bloated start menu, but you know,
and there's a way to actually, and I remember that one, but there's a way where instead of the tiles you get like a list of everything, like just a big list.
Yes,
so you can go through it, so it's kind of like having an exploded start menu but not exactly the tiles,
right? So you know, and then as Flick had mentioned, there are some things on some websites and videos online that'll help mitigate or ease some of the pain. But you know, if you're not a fan of Windows, what do you use your computer for?
Well, traditionally I've done a lot of documents, a lot of emails.
So like
I'm on the LSB and the PNB, so I get emails out the wazoo.
Word processing?
Yes, I'm word processing, but more emails and internet search. Do a lot of music downloads and
all legal, I assume.
Archive. archive.org.
Yeah, you could. I mean, yeah, you don't have to use Windows. I mean, and if you don't want to like pay the Apple tax, you could go to Linux. And Linux is going to be able to do, so for everything you describe, Linux would be able to do. And in fact, Linux Mint has a XP emulator interface that you can choose to run that looks like Windows XP.
I bet there's a 3.11 theme out there too for one of those desktops if you look hard enough.
Hopefully.
But you well, probably just run TWM.
Yeah.
Right. It's pretty much maybe before the Windows 3.1.1.
Well, the thing is that you know technology is going to continue to change and evolve. You know, unlike the weekly meeting of the LSB, which stays the same. But you have to, and the cool thing is that you know there are so many resources out there for figuring it out, and you know I frankly grow tired of the editorialization of Microsoft, you know, where people just say Microsoft sucks and the new operating system sucks. It's not like any of that complaining is going to result in an instant modification of the operating system you're sitting in front of. This is what we have. You know, Windows 8 is what we have. Microsoft's responding a little bit. It may be that the next version of Windows goes back to more of an XP or Windows 7 style. There's ways to emulate the Windows 7 / XP style in Windows 8 if you search for it. But really, once you kind of get used to the changes, it starts to make sense and it starts to logic itself out. If you could get to the point where you had a tile for Word and you had a tile for your email program and you had a tile for whatever web browser you're using...
Well, I've got that worked out.
So you would solve 90% of your problems.
If you're
just talking about day-to-day use of the computer, where I struggle and what I don't like in Windows 8 is that I do sometimes find myself fighting to get to certain control panels and menus that I use as on a more technical level trying to manage a system or troubleshoot things. So when I come up on, I have Windows 8 on a virtual machine on my Mac, but when I come up to a user who's got a desktop with Windows 8, I have to pause and I have to kind of engage. So I'm so used to what I've done for years and years that I have to kind of engage my brain and think about it and say, okay, how do I do this? But some of the shortcuts and some of the quick little fixes like the search menu are very helpful because once I get the search menu out in Windows 8, then I can start to find the things that I need to look for. I can type in control panel, it brings up control panel, or type programs, and I can get to my add remove programs and so forth. So it's there. It just takes a little bit more thinking, and I know that we get used to kind of going on autopilot, but what did you have before Windows 8?
Windows 7.
Okay, so you're at least...
I've made the full transition, everything along the way.
Right. Well, I mean, and if it is... I assume it's a brand new computer that you bought that had Windows 8 on it?
Yeah, new Samsung.
I mean, if you wanted to, you could explore the possibility of loading Windows 7 on that hardware. It might struggle a little bit with some of the drivers, but probably not. You could actually install Windows 7 on it if you wanted to go back. But you couldn't install Windows 3.1.1.
Well, my favorite. Yeah. Okay. So now, have you pulled up a God mode?
No, I have not.
I got that, and it's really great for settings because it has lots of settings pulled up under that one icon.
So is it? I have not. I hadn't actually heard of that.
Do it.
How to enable Windows 7 God mode? I've seen Windows 7 there, but. There it is. How to enable God mode on Windows 8.
Yeah, I've got it done on this one. And, the list is long of settings.
Long. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, now what about the, there are people that have out new faces for it, you know, that make it look more like the classic Windows version.
Well, I know that stuff exists. I have never been a fan of overlays. what I call overlays. It harkens back to the days of Packard Bell when they created their own interface to go over Windows 3.1. And they had these giant, like...
Did you ever use the one that was the... It looked like an outdoor mall courtyard with a fountain. And, like, you could click on the bookstore or the music store to go to your music or the... Oh, that was...
It was brutal.
Man, and the thing is, the computers didn't have hardly any processing power. And they're doing, like, moving video and sound audio, like,
menus
as your main... entrance on the
computer. Well, I just click on the fountain. What do you mean you just click on the fountain? I don't know what you're talking about. But I'd rather learn the actual interface than put something on top of it. But that being said, I've dealt with people who have used, like, I remember there's a big hue and cry when Microsoft Office changed their whole menuing system.
Yeah.
They went to that kind of banner across the top.
The ribbon.
Yeah.
And there were
some hacks that came out that restored the old style menu that you could install that would hack it back to a 2003 style of Office for your menus. And, you know, that kind of made sense with people that had been, you know, using Excel or Word or something the same way all their lives. But still, I tend to be more in the camp of saying, you know, buckle down and figure it out. Or if you continue to be unhappy with how Microsoft does their business, there are other operating systems out there.
Yeah. And
there are some free ones. I mean, if you wanted to, you could install one of the versions of Unix that Flicted was talking about or that Barrett likes to talk about. And you can even do it where you don't have to overwrite what you have. Now, one of the things with the Live, can you write to the hard drive with Live? Is there a way to set that up?
Yeah, most of the time when you say, hey, I want to go ahead and install this distribution, it'll say, hey, we've detected that you've got Windows 8 on a different partition. You know, how would you like to proceed? And you can say, hey, I want to resize that partition, make a new partition. I want to, you know.
Now, what I was wondering is, like, if you boot from one of the Live CDs and you don't install, can you save to your hard drive?
Yeah. Well, so
just an individual file.
I think it'll mount it, and it's
it shows up as like C Windows or something like that usually. So you can actually read files from the hard drive, write files back to it. So if you boot it up, you could read Office documents, for instance, you know, off your machine, and if you saved them back, you'd actually be saving the edits back to that file system.
Okay, so you could,
unless you've got like some weird funky TrueCrypt stuff where you've encrypted a partition, but for the most part, it can read them.
So you might, I mean, if you were interested, you could go out and get, you know, make an ISO or get an ISO and burn a disk of one of the popular, like Ubuntu or Mint or something like that, just to see what you thought of that operating system. Because I know a number of those have desktops that are very similar to Windows 7 or Windows XP. They emulate that environment. So it might be, an option.
Yeah, the one fun thing to do is when those pull up, there'll be a little place where you can log in, and then right below there on Mint and on most of them, you'll have a little drop-down box where you can choose your window manager, and each one of those window managers, they behave very, very differently and look differently. So I would just run through those and find one you like.
Cool thing is that if you use one of these Live CDs, basically what happens is you boot your computer up, it loads the operating system into memory, it doesn't touch your file system. So you take that CD out, you reboot your computer, it comes right back to what you had before. So it's basically just kind of like a run-in-memory type of operating system so you can get a feel for it and see what you think of it. So if you get tired enough of fighting or banging your head against the Microsoft wall, there are some other options out there.
BOS.
Well, I'll consider it. Sounds like I just need to probably go ahead and learn A.
It's not so bad.
8.1 will make it better, like they said.
And do consider 8.1. There are some dramatic changes. Well, not so dramatic, but there's more a push back towards the Windows 7 style interface in the Windows 8.1 update, and there's going to be more updates coming that kind of tame the whole thing, I think.
Okay.
All right.
Time for a shameless plug. You guys need to listen to my show on HD3 from 9 to midnight on Sunday evenings, Electronica and Jam.
Nice. All right.
What kind of electronica?
Sound Tribe Sector 9, Disco Biscuits, Papa Dosio, things like that.
The jam goes with the biscuits.
Yummy.
All right.
Foodie show.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for answering.
All right. No problem. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, I don't like to play on God mode. I don't use God mode in Windows 8 at all. I play on Nightmare mode, and even though it takes me like 2 days to change my screen resolution, when I do it, I feel a very big sense of accomplishment. No cheats.
713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us. Who's up next, Groovehouse?
Up next.
If you don't mind waking up from your little nappy nap.
I'm sorry, what?
What? Okay, I got to clean something. Hold on. Hang on.
Up next, we're going to speak with William.
William, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Yeah. I got a SanDisk thing. Can I go take it off the speaker, right?
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
So I've got a few SanDisk thumb drives that I've had for years back, and they all had this U3 encryption embedded into it.
Yeah.
And, I can't seem to run them on the Windows 7. Do you know anything about that? Can I run it on some kind of local drive or something that emulates the XP?
It looks like there is a U3 Launchpad update for Windows 7 that might be available from SanDisk.
Okay. So. I went to the site a while back, and you know, when I tried to investigate it, they just said it didn't support Windows 7, but maybe they've got something out there since then.
Well, I was reading. I just did a search on SanDisk U3 Windows 7, and it said now there's a U3 launch pad on Windows 7 that you can install. I don't know if is it a matter of trying to access your files that you have saved on the U3 or SanDisk?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it doesn't open them up.
What do you find?
It says that I found the one that you found. It says that password protection has to be disabled to be able to open up those files from
password
Windows 7.
Password protection for Windows 7?
Yeah, or no, on that file. So if he's put a password on it, he can't open them up on 7, at least with the thing I'm seeing from the knowledge base from SanDisk.
Yeah, right, there was passwords.
Which is funky. You would think they would have updates for that.
Well, the other option that you would have, I suppose, is now, is there a reason why you were using the U3 encryption as opposed to the Windows encryption? Just because it was there. I encountered the U3 disks for a brief period of time, but I never went for the encryption. I'm always afraid of encryption because I'm afraid I'll never get back to my data.
Yeah, I should have been too. I mean, it was just part of the software that was built in with
You could try loading XP onto a virtual machine. I wonder if that would allow you to get access to the files. But no, it looks like it is a common problem.
Have you tried, I suppose you've tried installing it in compatibility mode and then installing it as administrator?
In Windows 7?
Yeah.
No, I haven't tried that.
You might want to give that a shot. Do you know how to launch something and run it in compatibility mode?
Okay, I can give it a shot.
I think if you right-click on it, I think you might be able to do it from properties, possibly. If you right-click on it and then, you know, go through the tabs, there should be something that says, like, run in XP compatibility mode 32-bit or something along those lines. You might want to give that a shot.
Okay.
So yeah. You can't even read it at all when you plug it into the Windows 7 computer?
No, it doesn't even recognize it as a USB.
And so if you plug it back into another computer running XP or something, it will read it?
I don't have an active XP anymore.
So we don't know for sure that there's not a problem with the drive.
Yeah, but I got multiple ones. I got three or four of this thing with a bunch of old photos and stuff.
Well, I'd try the compatibility mode option, but I would also maybe see if you could find somebody who has an older computer that you might be able to plug it into and see about maybe disabling the encryption or disabling the password and then see if the update for Windows 7 will work.
Okay.
Because with all the U3 drives that I've ever encountered, I've wiped out the U3 stuff on them and reformatted
and
them.
And installed U2.
Still haven't found what I was looking for.
That was your fear.
Initially, it was set up so you could run it, you know, on your work computer without any history, right? So,
right.
But I'm not sure if it's any good if you can't open it up.
No, it's not. That's like I said. That's the problem that I come across with various brands of encryption is without the right software to get and decrypt it and get after it again, that sometimes your data just exists, but you can't access it. What'd you find, Barrett?
There, I found on the SanDisk site, if you Google for SanDisk Cruiser not recognized by Windows 7, there is, now it's command line, but they've got a three-step process where you go in and you remove a file that's, you know, doing a device association with that. And when you remove the file, you reboot, it should pop back up. It's called usbstore.inf. And again, this is just one, it may or may not work, but a lot of things are pointing here, and they've got an official knowledge base article on it.
Okay, I'll give it a shot.
Yeah, I just did a search on SanDisk Cruiser Windows 7 and found the same article that Barrett's referencing, so that might be a good option for you.
Okay, it's probably a lot of problems. Everybody hems up with their old ones.
Yeah, I mean, and like Jay said, I mean, worst case, the best bet might just be to go get, like, a really large USB stick that's not encrypted, go find some with an XP machine, and then get all that data off and onto, you know, something that's not encrypted.
Right. All righty.
All right.
Good luck.
Thanks
for your call. Bye. Speaking of encryption, you know, I feel bad. One of my users called into the IT department, and he had gotten hit, as I diagnosed and looked at his computer, he'd gotten hit by CryptoLocker. Mm. Familiar with that one? CryptoLocker, what it does is when it installs on your computer and it's got a, it looks for anything that's .pdf, .doc, .docx, you know, any of your Excel, PDF, Word, any documents.
Holds them for ransom?
It encrypts them.
Ransomware?
Well, yes, it's ransomware. What it does then is it sets a public key and then it sends itself to a server, a private key. And they say, okay. And then when you start your computer, it pops up a web page and it's got some links on there that talk about, you know, if you want your data back, click here. And you click on the link and it's a code specific to you. It says you've got so many hours to pay us to recover your data, or the price will go up double. And then if you don't do it after that time, we're just going to delete the key and you won't be able to get your data back. Now, what they've done that makes it even harder is that they will not take your money. They will only take Bitcoin.
Wow.
So currently the ransom on this guy's files, and this is assuming they even give you the key, but they give you some vague instructions on how to go buy some Bitcoin. So you have to buy 2 Bitcoin, so $500 if you want your data back. 2 Bitcoin to get the private key to decrypt your data. And somebody did some calculations. I mean, they said that probably if, you know, with all the infections, if only 5% of the people pay the ransom, this company's making millions of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
There's no outfit. There's whoever they are in Russia or wherever they're at. Because people say, I need my data. And my guy said, well, should I pay him? And I said, I wouldn't. I mean, I know your data is important, but I don't think I'd pay him because, you know, you can't pay the terrorists.
I didn't realize this. CryptoLocker goes after attached network drives, too. So if you're, like, camped out on the corporate network and you've got a drive mapped, it's going to encrypt that.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
I didn't. That's a little bit on the, I need to look and see if there's any way to block that. But, I mean, if someone's got legitimate access, that's kind of hard to filter out. Like, okay, do they have legitimate file access to this file server, or are they doing stuff they shouldn't be doing? That's kind of scary.
Yeah, so I don't know how the package got delivered to his computer, but it got it all. And every folder that has encrypted files has 3 different link files in there that have the HTML and a text file and all that tell you how to go back and get it. And then when you click on the link, it actually shows you the countdown timer for your files.
Mm.
And there's the new version. The version that he had is actually newer than the one that you're looking there at. There's a CryptoLocker version, too. And it is extremely nasty. And it only affects Windows computers, but there's a lot of it going around. So here's, okay, and the other thing that it does, it's horrible, is that it goes and disables System Restore.
So you can't back up then.
So you can't go back to, because if it didn't disable System Restore, you could at least use System Restore and then go to restore previous versions on your files, which would get you the unencrypted version. So back up your data, and I don't know if it would actually encrypt your backup disk, but according to people I'm reading, it's not. They're able to get their stuff from their backups or cloud backups at the very
least. I would think if you're backing up straight to like an attached USB drive and that USB drive's attached, it's possible that it could encrypt that as well. So I would, you know, when you're not running backups, I would pull the backup drive.
Yeah, it's bad, and there's a lot of people that are getting hit with it. It's spreading around pretty good. It's been going around since the end of last year, and you go to open up your Excel document, and basically you just see gibberish. It's really nasty. All right, Groovehouse. Sorry, Groovehouse, didn't need to wake you up.
No, I'm awake.
Okay,
I'm up.
Go ahead. Who do we have up?
Hotel.
Oops, sorry.
Up next on the show, we are going to speak with Tyler.
Tyler, you're on the air.
Yes, hi there, guys. Jeez, that was diabolical what you were talking about.
It is diabolical. That's a good word to describe it.
Wow. I have a music question.
Freebird.
Freebird. Okay. interesting. Actually, yeah, Freebird. Can you think of it? Is that? I'll come back to that.
All right.
But there are some speakers out called Freebird speakers by a French company called Focal. But I've just bought a music system that included these Focal speakers. No, they're called Superbird, not Freebird. Never mind. Anyway, I also bought a Sonos Connect and a Sonos Bridge. And so I guess the bridge has to go on my router, and then I have to figure out how to set up the Sonos Connect. And then it uses like an iPad, which is sort of your database of, you know, any kind of wireless music that you want.
Well, yeah, you could use, as I understand it, you can use it to, you know, you could like pop your phone into it, or it can reach out to your, if you have a Mac or a Windows computer with iTunes on it on your network, you can set that library up to be shared, and it can be played out over the Sonos system, and you can play different music on different speakers in different rooms. So if you have the Sonos system set up and you have one of the speakers in your kitchen, or another one in the bedroom, maybe one on the back patio, they could all be configured to play different playlists out of your iTunes library, or connect directly to an iPad or an iPhone from the music that's playing on that, as I've read about it.
Yeah, that's how they described it to me.
Yeah.
But I am intimidated with the thought of setting this up, and then the thought of figuring out how to use it. So I wondered about what kind of resources you guys might know of. I went to the Apple store and I said, do y'all give, you know, do y'all install, and do you give classes, or maybe how to work with all this stuff? And they sort of said no.
The Sonos stuff should be pretty easy to set up. I mean, I know like 5 and 10 years ago when it first came out, there was a little bit of juggling you had to do, but I've heard it's extremely easy. Have you seen if there's like any YouTube?
First of all, have you just tried?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. It's all in the box now.
So you went online. You said, this sounds really good, I'm going to buy it, and it arrived at you, and the glossy color pictures on the box just stare at you menacingly, daring you to open them and see if the instructions are comprehensible.
Exactly. That's about the size of it. Yes.
Okay. First, I would say Barrett's going to offer you some really good information here in a second, but I will tell you this. I had a sales guy, one of my sales guys, come up to me. And, you know, I love my sales guys because they sell our product and they make money for the company. But they're salespeople. They're not technical people.
I got some of these new SunOS systems.
One of them was just the, look, Jay, you know, I know you're the computer guy, but I want to tell you about this thing I found that you might be interested in. It's called Sonos. And he started to tell me about how he's got his whole house
Sonos, it's that easy.
He's got his house all rigged up with Sonos system, and he did it all himself, and he's very proud, and it really was not very hard, apparently. And if a sales guy can do it, then I think anybody can do it. That's my philosophy, and it's
YouTube has a Sonos. I mean, has a Sonos channel, or rather, Sonos has a channel on YouTube, and they've got all kinds of setup instructions, and it's built into where it doesn't even feel like a YouTube page. You just kind of click through, and you can say like, "Hey, I want to, you know, like learn more." It'll show you how to set it up, and it's really easy. Like Jay said, you could probably take it out of the box and just go.
I would imagine you take it out of the box, and there's probably this big glossy and fold out. I would hope, maybe, that, like, I know they did this with Linksys routers for a long time. They might
even
still
do it. Super color-coded, very easy to read.
They pull out this thing, and it shows you this picture of the router, and it shows you a picture of what to plug in where, and it takes you through big red number one, step two, do this, do that. And it might be easier than you think.
No matter which piece of equipment you've got, whether you've got, I think you said maybe the Kinect, or you've got the Bridge, or you've got whatever, you can click on that, and they've got like a video showing you how to set that particular piece of equipment up.
Because if I had to guess, what this does is it connects to your router, either on the Wi-Fi or you plug it into an Ethernet port, but it's going to connect to your network.
Yes, that's correct.
So that it can then see any media libraries or media devices on your network, and
that's currently being shared.
That's being shared, and then send that to various speakers you have at various locations in your house.
Exactly.
And they probably tell you how to go turn on the sharing.
It's going to go search for stuff. It's going to do a lot of stuff for you. It's this stuff isn't aimed at like computer engineers, it's aimed at you. It's made to
it's
be able
for
to
the
be
consumer.
Set up for
it's set up so you can do your home media system, and it's probably, like I said, I think it's going to be easier than you think. That being said, you bought it online?
No, I went to a store. I actually went to a store, and the salesman, you know, sort of said, "Here, this is what you need." And I was like, "Wow, that's really cool. I love the idea of it." And
what store?
The product looks neat. I went to Modea. They have a store on Westheimer.
Yeah, it's like a kind of higher end.
Yeah, they're higher end, and they'll do the installation, but it'll cost more than I paid for the whole thing.
Yeah,
right.
So
take it out of the box. You can do this.
Do you have any technical friends?
I might have a few technical friends who could.
Somebody who's a bit of an audiophile who might want to be exposed to this kind of technology.
If they haven't set it up, and you're just like, "Hey, I got this Sonos system, and I haven't set it up yet," they may go, "Really? So when are you going to set it up? Like, you think I could check it out?" "Sure, you want to help me set it up?" "Yeah, cool." And then just sit back, and they'll take over.
Yeah.
That would be good. And I could feed them all the beer they wanted.
Exactly. Beer and pizza. Beer and pizza.
And pizza with M&Ms.
And Cheetos.
Yes.
But it looks to me like it's it's easy for me to say, but it looks like it's pretty easy to set up.
Although after you get it set up, you might have to listen to a lot of They Might Be Giants or something while they're testing it out.
But as I understand it, it should be pretty straightforward. I would imagine you hook up the main part first, and it's going to ask you, you know, if you're going to pair your additional speakers with it. It'll ask you, I don't know what the interface is or how you actually interface with it, whether it's through a web interface or something, but it should tell you.
Yeah, install, go to the Play Store or whatever the iTunes store is, and actually go download the Sonos app to your iPhone or to your tablet, and then launch that. It'll actually walk you through. It'll say, like, "Hey, power on your base station. We're going to try and search for it. Okay, we found it." And it'll walk you through how to set stuff up, it looks like, just by watching the video on mute.
Yeah, he was just watching one of the instructional videos with the sound muted and figured that part out. But I would start with the instructions, start with the basics, get the base set up, and then build out from there. Get the very basics set up for the first part. And if you got any additional speakers or whatever, add those on later. But get the main system working. Figure out how it's going to interface with whether it's your iPhone or your iPad or whatever. It should be pretty straightforward and work really easy. And if not, how long ago did you buy it?
I just picked it up this last weekend.
Okay, so I would get on this right away, and if you don't like it, then just box it all back up and go tell that smart mouth know-it-all to give me my money back.
Yeah, I can't live with it. Okay. No, this sounds brilliant. You just hearing you step through it makes it sound like it's a lot easier than I feared. So.
Yeah. I've just been setting up. I have a smart TV, and I've just paired it with a video streaming server I set up on my computer, and I'm surprised even at that how simple it's become. Yeah, once you have the right components in place, and I've done some research on the Sonos product, and it really is geared towards the consumer to be able to attach to their media and be able to bring that, you know, to life and big sound around your house. And
yeah,
it looks like there are some rather complex aspects of it when you start talking about managing multiple media libraries and having different things happen in different rooms. But just for straightforward, I want my sound off my iPhone or my iPad to be played on great speakers so it fills the room with sound. Looks like that part is going to be super
Sonos
easy.
Sonos has been plugging away at it for a while. So, and it seems like in the last year or two, somebody invested a lot of money or they punched money into the company or something happened because they've started doing a lot more marketing, and it seems like their products have become easier to use and can do more. I mean, they've always been in, as far as I know, I mean, I remember them being around for years in the, like, streamed music, you know, over the network category is like a one-stop box that, you know, you just plug it in, and I think it used to take more configuration.
Now, did you say you have the Kinect?
Yes, I have the Sonos Kinect. I have the Sonos Bridge, which apparently the bridge sits on top of the router. And then the Kinect plugs into your stereo receiver, and then it ties into your iPad.
So basically it's going to allow you to take your iPad music and play this through your existing stereo equipment.
Exactly, that's correct.
Now, were you comfortable setting up your own stereo?
No, I have to do that part as well. And actually, setting up the stereo is not the hard part, but I've got to run some wires through the wall.
There are less wires on your Sonos than there probably are on your stereo.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a very easy hookup. There's not much to it. I'm looking at the actual install guide right now on the bridge, and it's real, really easy.
There's other ways also to do that if you want to get your computer music onto your home stereo because, for example, I use an Apple TV. It's $99. Hook your Apple TV up to your receiver and your TV, and
then you could get to your it'll read your iTunes library,
and then you actually can see it on your TV, and you can use your iPhone or the Apple remote or whatever, you know, to control it, and it actually has HDMI out and optical audio out. So if you have Toslink or HDMI, hook that up to your TV and your stereos. Because like I have a TV, but TV speakers pretty much are always not good. So I have all my sound running actually into my stereo. So the Apple TV feeds into my stereo.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
And I use that to stream audio.
It's a cheaper solution. It's not as, you know, turnkey as maybe the Sonos. But you say your stereo is not hooked up either?
No, stereo's not hooked up yet either. No.
Has it ever been hooked up?
No. I mean, it's all this whole system. I just picked it up this past weekend. So
you bought a stereo
at a high end stereo shop,
and you bought the Sonos Kinect to hook everything to the stereo.
Right.
What stereo did you buy?
I bought a Rotel receiver.
They make tomatoes, right?
They know. It's for chili con queso.
Yummy.
Yeah.
Wow. It sounds like you, it sounds like you kind of just went off the deep end.
Drop some coin.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I haven't had a stereo for a number of years, and I thought, you know.
Wow,
really
the Rotel looks great.
Yeah. It's pretty.
What kind of speakers?
They're called Focal, F-O-C-A-L. They're made in France.
Are those the Thunderbird or the Superbird speakers?
Yes.
Are they the oval ones?
Yes.
Yeah, those are cool. Yeah. I'll come over and set it up.
Seriously, you need an audio nerd to come over. bought some really nice gear.
Here's what you do. Go to, like, there are a couple of record shops in Houston that sell vinyl, and just loudly just talk into your phone, pretend you've got a phone call, and be like, oh.
Why
and
would
just start
get, no, a vinyl store?
A vinyl store, and just start dropping the names of the speakers and the components.
But there's too many. There's, I mean, I think
and
the
people
Sonos,
will follow you home.
I think the Sonos iPhone connection part will turn off the audio files. I mean, if you're
talking
about...
Don't mention that part at first. Mention the...
Yeah.
Because audio files seem to struggle with new technology.
Well, they're going to say, like, if you pull out the Sonos thing, they'll say, like, oh, it's 128-bit DAC, and you lose this and you lose that. But whatever, it's convenience. But, you know, they will want to check out your receiver.
And then go, but it can stream FLAC.
Yeah. Og Vorbis, you know. I'm half kidding, but there probably would be people. You probably don't want anyone from a record store following you home.
I don't think I would just go solicit a stranger to help you set up your stereo.
Especially after you've listed out all your expensive new purchases that are still in the box. Directly stolen and
sold. I would say, but based on what you're describing that you bought, I don't know that the install would be more expensive than the projection. It might double the price, but wow. First of all, you're going to have to sit down. We need to have to let you go here in a second, but you're going to have to sit down and just get the stereo all wired in.
Okay.
Just get all that working.
Okay.
Do that first.
All right.
Because the Sonos isn't going to get you very far unless you have the working stereo. So get the stereo set up, get your speakers mounted, placed however you like. Make sure that you can play a CD, play the radio, whatever you've got. Get that working. And then then open up the Sonos and read that and see how that's going to connect to your stereo.
Okay.
Do you have a Freebird MP3, or do we need to mail you one?
That's the first song you should play when it's all done.
Not an MP, not an MP3, though, because it's not high enough
quality.
Okay,
FLAC, sorry.
Or a record. Did you get a turntable?
Pardon?
Did you get a turntable to go with this?
No, I haven't got a turntable yet, but I will.
Okay, good. Cool, good.
Some point,
all right, well, good luck to you.
Thank you so much, guys. All
please,
great suggestions. Thank
please,
you.
Please call us back and give us an update on how this is going.
I will. Hopefully it won't be months and months.
No, hopefully it won't. All right, have a good night. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wow, I think that she might have... They must have saw her coming. Maybe she drove up in her Lexus or something and said...
I think that's more than a Lexus.
G-Wagon.
You think it's a like a Mercedes?
I'm just joking, but maybe. Jaguar. Yeah. Who knows?
Audi R8.
Maybe a Jaguar.
I mean, I almost want to go set this up.
I'm only half joking on that. I'm going to go hang out at audio stores and listen for a lady on her phone talking about high-end stereo equipment. And I'm gonna
she can come to the Geek Gathering a week from Friday and, you know, maybe arrange to take someone home with her to set up her stereo.
Hey-o!
All right. Groovehouse?
Yes.
Who do we have up next?
Up next, we're going to speak with AC.
AC, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Okay, here I am. I have a question, but I just have a comment that I could follow on for your previous caller. She can go to any Apple store, and they can point her at a website, or she can look up, find Apple consultants, and some of those guys are small shops, and they might like that kind of a job, you know, which is crosses over from the Apple to other stuff, especially the Apple TV. So that's a recommendation. Go to an Apple store, ask for people who are not Apple employees but are Apple consultants, and there's a website, and you type in your zip code, and you find a bunch of guys, half a dozen guys, a dozen guys.
Okay.
My question is about Apple operating system and either a theory, a recommendation, or a myth that if you keep the number of files and folders on the desktop, you prevent the machine from slowing down over time. Is any truth to that?
Now, you're saying that if you do or you don't put the folders on your desktop?
If you keep, a lot of people, you walk up to their machine and they got hundreds of folders on the desktop. If you keep that number low of stuff exposed on the desktop, you tend to keep the machine from slowing down.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. The fewer things you have on your desktop, the better. The more you have on your desktop, but mostly in terms of shortcuts or actual document files, if you have your desktop too full, it will slow your machine
because
down.
It's doing previews for everything, or why?
I'm not exactly sure why, but it will slow it down because, I mean, it has to build It has to do with the way it builds the thumbnail cache.
The live desktop. Okay.
And it will slow your system.
But I would think once it's built it, then...
I don't think it will slow it down that much. My experience has been when I see someone with a ton of stuff on their desktop, that is usually indicative of other bad computing habits. And they usually have a lot of other stuff that is also slowed down the machine if they just save everything to the desktop. But I do know, you know, like when you open up something and it'll generate all the thumbnails and all the previews for it, that might take a second or two to load. But I would suspect that once it does that, once they're in memory, once they're on the desktop, that's that.
I have a lot of stuff on my desktop.
I like a clean desktop. I'll have one folder called desktop folder and everything will be in that folder just because I don't want anything on my desktop. So
I have not verified it, but I have, that's not unheard of. I've heard this myth or heard this rumor.
I don't think I've ever heard that. I'm trying to think of, I mean, I can think of possibilities of why it might affect it, but I wouldn't think it would be that big of an effect because it still is just the file system, just like anything else is in the file system. But I mean, but it is going to have to display it, and so it is going to have to create thumbnails of it. And if it has to refresh that every once in a while, refreshing one thing versus refreshing 500 things is going to take more time, but it's like minuscule amounts of time. So
I don't know. I think there is something to that. I do think there's something to it, and I can't remember what it was. And I think I've actually seen it where, like,
my system hasn't felt slow. I mean, I've got a lot of stuff on my
on
my Apple.
I think this is a Windows thing.
Oh.
Hey, one thing you could do if that really is true, you could just create one single folder and call like desktop folder, and then do a control A, grab all your files except for the desktop folder, and drag them all into that, and just see.
And then if it's still slow, create a folder in that one called desktop and put it in there and just keep doing that until it gets faster.
Well, okay, thanks a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of chatter about it, and some of it has to do with repainting or refreshing the preview. And
I know that one of the things Windows does when you log in as a new user, it prepares your desktop. So there is a strong interaction with the desktop, and I think having all those icons. I mean, that being said, my desktop is full to the point where it almost goes to a second screen that doesn't exist, full of icons. It's so messy. But if you want to do some benchmark tests, you could take all the icons that you have on your desktop and scoop them up and throw them in a folder, and then test and see if it
speeds up.
Seems
like somebody could test this. I mean, just build out a new system. Put 1,000 things on the desktop, run some tests, have nothing on the desk, nothing, not even a folder at all, nothing on the desktop, run some tests and see if there's any...
Giving it some thought, I see the preview stuff. I know there's also a way that where you can disable preview. That's another thing. But I can see if someone had like 1,200 megabyte Excel spreadsheets and it had to open up each one of those files, generate a preview from the first page and close it back down, I could see that maybe. But you're getting into extreme cases, I think.
Well, the person that I actually trust on such matters, Leo, not Leo Laporte, but Ask Leo from Leo Nottenboom, he says it's false. He says that, clutter's a bad thing, and there's many reasons for keeping your desktop uncluttered. But he says the only technical thing I could think of for people who have a lot of things on their desktop is literally the amount of time it takes to display the desktop and display all of those icons. In a worst-case scenario, the operating system has to go through and read every single file that has an icon on the desktop to determine what the icon should be. If you've got lots and lots of icons, lots and lots of things on your desktop, that can take some time. But ultimately, the short answer is no, it shouldn't be an issue. It's a matter of personal preference. It's not the way he would do it, but it's up to you. Now, I do know that your thumbnail cache can cause problems with your icons, and every once in a while you have to go and blow away your thumbnail cache and tell Windows to rebuild all the thumbnails.
Well, even on Apple devices, there's definitely some problems sometimes with the Spotlight
searching
thing where you can do some stuff that will cause it to slow down and slow your entire computer down and make it behave poorly.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for your call. Bye.
So we went all the way around in a big circle on that one.
Well, I was ready to believe it.
If you Google that, there are plenty of people who say that they got to where they had problems and that when they took that, it slowed down their computer. When they took the stuff and put it in a folder away from the desktop,
when they slowed down their computer and then rebooted it after it had been up for a year and a half, yeah. It was definitely a lot faster.
There are also people that have seen Elvis and Aliens on the internet. So,
all right, we got one last call in the queue, or it looks like. So let's have that, Groovehouse.
All right, we're going to speak with Harold.
Harold, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Yes, sir. Hey, it's not brand new, but I bought a computer from a friend of mine that he's had it for maybe 6 months to a year. And I'm trying to hook up to my wireless network, like my router, but it's not finding any other networks. And I was wondering if you knew how to.
I see. You bought a used laptop from a friend.
Yes, sir.
All right. So did your friend tell you that everything should work?
Yeah, he said everything's in good working condition. I mean,
had he ever used it wirelessly?
He said he did. I've never seen it, but I bought a home thing and I got on it, and I bought up the Kinect 2, I clicked on it, and then I bought up all networks. I tried to refresh it, reload it, and then nothing else pops up except for the dial-up thing or whatever.
Now, what operating system is it?
It's XP.
Okay. In XP, you should see a little icon down by the clock that tells you if it sees any wireless networks.
It has an X on it.
Okay, that might mean that it's turned off.
How do you turn it on?
What kind of laptop is it?
It's an Acer.
Okay, I don't know. Some have a physical switch somewhere on the side, or sometimes the top.
A little slide switch
actually will turn the Wi-Fi off.
Yeah, there might be a little slider switch that has the icon for wireless looks like an antenna, like an inverted V.
Oh, yeah, but there's no switches on it anywhere.
All right, if it's not a switch, do look carefully, like Barrett said. Like, look on the sides.
Yes, sir.
Look for a slider.
I remember there was a Dell that had it front and center, like right under at the bottom of the screen above the keyboard. There was a little slider that you could.
Do you know the model number of the Acer?
No, sir. I don't see a switch or nothing.
All right, if it's not a switch, then it's a function key. So it might be. If you look on your function keys at the top of the keyboard,
yes, sir.
One of them might have a little Wi-Fi symbol.
Well, there's an antenna. Not an antenna, but a satellite dish. It looks like.
That might be it.
That might be it, but it's more like an antenna. But it could be a.
It's not a button, though. It looks like glass.
No, this is going to be usually like blue writing at the tops of your number keys, maybe, or the tops of whatever you have along the top. It'll be like, you know, you might have like an 8 key, and there may be something else on there, a function key with something else up there.
Oh, okay, wait, it's blinking now. I didn't push a button, but it's a piece of glass on the satellite dish. I just touched it and it started blinking.
Okay. It probably turned it on.
That might have turned it on.
Oh, okay. Well, okay.
Try it again.
So now try
with it.
Okay.
Talk to your friend too. He might know about how to enable the Wi-Fi on that thing.
Oh, okay. Let me try to connect it then.
Well, listen, we're out of time, but we wish you a lot of luck and thanks for your call. We got to sign off though. Make way for the next show.
Good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. If you get the model number of the Acer and you email it to me, I'll do some research and find out how to turn on and off the Wi-Fi. But
he may have just gotten it.
He might have gotten it. It sounds like he might have gotten it. All right. Well, you've been listening to Technology Bites here. And it's another show in the can. We're done. We're done. We're done. We'll be back.
Isn't this a Geek Gathering week?
It's next week. It's a week from Friday is the Geek Gathering.
First Friday.
The first Friday before the first Saturday, but not always. No, it is always. No.
No, Saturday is the first.
Damn you, Victor. But yeah, we'll be posting information and talking more about that next week. But we do have a Geek Gathering coming. We hope you'll join us. Thanks for tuning in. This has been Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse Keeper
Tenato.
If you enjoy
enjoy worldwide music and dancing, join the Houston International Folk Dancers twice weekly as we celebrate dances and rhythms from over 36 countries. No partner needed to learn easy dances from Greece, Eastern Europe, Italy, the Americas, and other countries, while having fun with an informal and friendly group. Newcomers Night is on Mondays at Oddfellows Hall in the Heights, 115 East 14th Street from 7:30 to 10 p.m. Friday Night Folk Dancing is held at the Unitarian Church, 5200 Fannin, from 7:30 to 10 p.m. You can visit folkdancers.org to learn more about Houston International Folk Dancers. See you on the dance floor. This is KPFT, Houston. A regular listener to KPFT, no doubt you've heard our fund drives. This hour, you can reduce fund drives with one simple step. Sustaining members make a convenient, ongoing monthly contribution, which means less mail, no renewal notices, and uninterrupted status as a KPFT member. Sustaining membership is an easy and efficient way for you to support the programs you rely on through secure, automatic monthly payments from your credit card, debit card, or bank account. This means we'll deduct your designated contribution from your account until you let us know to stop or change it. And the more sustaining members KPFT has, the more regular revenue and less need to interrupt programming for fund drives. Just visit kpft.org now to be a sustaining